And this is Christoph Sichy, and he will talk about tensor network investigations of the Thiering model, particularly the phase structure and real-time dynamics. Please, Christoph, go ahead.
Okay, so first of all, thanks to the organizers for the invitation to give this talk and also for organizing this very nice workshop. So I will talk about a pretty much less well-known model, less popular than other models from lattice field theory that are considered with tensor network methods. But nevertheless, after this model was formulated, it got pretty much attention, especially in the 60s and 70s, and some very notable physicists have worked on this, like Sidney Coleman has done some impressive work in it, also Edward Witten or Julian Schwinger, they all worked on this model. So I will concentrate on the phase structure on this model, which is based on our paper that was out last year, and also on some fresh results that are work in progress for the real-time dynamics. Okay, so the main interest of the lattice QCD community in tensor network methods is motivated by the aim of eventually going to QCD and using the tensor network methods to solve the infamous sign problem of Monte Carlo simulations. And in this review that you have advertised in this slide, you can read more about this thread. We review the tensor network approach for lattice cage theories and also other methods that allow you to circumvent the sign problem. So some of these methods are really prospective, and one can really imagine that QCD can be really tackled, the QCD phase diagram can be determined from first principles using these methods. So these are methods like Lefschetz-Thimbles or complex Langevin, and also tensor networks. It's clearly in this group of prospective methods. But there are also these classical methods, so to say, that are pretty hopeless, but for some reason people still continue using them. It's maybe some kind of inertia to continue using methods that are hopeless. But anyway, tensor networks are definitely in this group that can allow us to go to QCD at some point. But still one can also try to use these methods for other models that are not directly on the road to using them for QCD, and Thiering model is one of such models. So our main motivation for this project is to investigate the Thiering model with tensor network techniques. This is a quantum field theory describing self-interactions of the Dirac field in 1+1 dimensions. And its main feature is that it shows a non-trivial zero temperature phase structure in the mass interaction plane. There is a gapless or critical phase, and there is also a gapped or massive phase, and they are separated by a Berezinski-Kosterloos-Stahles type transition. So our question that we asked at the beginning of this project is how effective can be MPS to study such a quantum field theory? And the additional motivation that came later is to try to probe the real-time dynamics, and in particular, to see whether there are some dynamical quantum phase transitions in this model. So the model itself is quite old. It was introduced in 1958 as an example of solvable relativistic quantum field theory. This was a time when several such models were formulated, also the Schwinger model a little bit later, or the Gross-Nevin model, which is related to the Thiering model. And they allowed people to get some generic insights into quantum field theories, even though that these are pretty simple models. So the Thiering model is defined by this action that you have here. There's a kinetic term, a mass term, and a four-fermion coupling. And a very important feature of the Thiering model is that its zero-charge sector is equivalent to the sign-Gordon theory, so a strictly bosonic theory defined by this action that you can see. And this equivalence was proven in a very seminal paper and a very insightful one by Sidney Coleman. And the paper is also, in general, many papers from this period devoted to these simple quantum field theories. They are very pedagogical and insightful, and also the language is kind of different than what we typically use now for the papers. So, for example, Coleman in his paper put it in such words that one of the most striking features is that a theory which is obviously a theory of fermions is equivalent to a theory which is obviously a theory of bosons. So this is the essence of this equivalence of the fermionic Fearing model and the bosonic Sine-Gordon theory. So he also derived some duality relations between the two models, so the zero charge sector of the Fearing model and the Sine-Gordon theory. And one should also mention that another equivalence is to the two-dimensional XY model at non-zero temperature. So the coupling of the Fearing model becomes the temperature of the XY model. This equivalence between Thiering and Sine-Gordon leads to the possibility of investigating the renormalization group flow of the Thiering model based on this equivalence of the previous slide. So this equivalence holds in the limit where the cutoff is sufficiently high, such that the mass over the cutoff lambda is much smaller than one, and in the region of couplings G larger than minus pi. If you go below minus pi, the spectrum actually becomes unbounded. So one equation is for the beta function, so that the running of the coupling with this renormalization scale, and the other equation is for the mass anomalous dimension. And this RG flow is summarized in the following cartoon, and some properties that you can infer from these RG equations are given here, that the massless theory is conformal, the coupling always increases towards the infrared, so when you go with mu to zero, then the coupling increases, and there are these two phases, this conformal phase, in this phase the mass term is irrelevant, and there is the gapped phase where the mass term is relevant. And the transition between the two regimes is at some coupling denoted by G star. In the massless limit, this is equal to minus pi over two. But if you are in the massive theory, then the position of this transition changes. And one of our motivations was to try to see where this transition is in the massive model. Okay, so we need the Hamiltonian to use the tensor networks techniques. And in the case of the Thiering model, the Hamiltonian cannot be simply related to the Lagrangian using a straightforward Legendre transform, because there is a quantum anomaly such that the quantum effects modify current conservation laws, and this leads to an ambiguity in defining the vector current. In the path integral formalism, there is a well-known solution of this via an anomalous transformation of the measure. And in the operator formalism, it's a bit more subtle, and this ambiguity can be resolved by a non-local definition of the currents, as first shown by Schwinger. And incorporating these quantum effects, the Hamiltonian becomes what you have in this equation. And note here that the structure of the four fermion coupling has changed. So this is an important effect that has to be taken into account. And in the standard representation of gamma matrices, one can write the Hamiltonian in the following form, defining for convenience this coupling G tilde. Then we want to go to the lattice, so we use the staggered discretization to get rid of the doubler mode in the spatial direction. The time direction is of course continuous, so there's only this one doubler mode. So we do it with such an identification. And the staggered Hamiltonian for n sides becomes this equation. And then for convenience, we want to go to a spin model. So we perform a Jordan-Wigner transformation. So you see that the model becomes the XXZ model coupled to both a uniform magnetic field and a staggered magnetic field. And then there is another subtlety here in the D-ring model that the choice of parameters in terms of G does not account for the lattice effects. And this was investigated in the 70s by two physicists with rather similar surnames. One of them became later a very prominent figure of the lattice QCD community. And in these papers, basing on the soliton bond state spectrum, and they performed matching between an exactly solvable field theory at zero mass and the XXZ chain. And they found the correct choice of the parameters. And in terms of this choice of parameters, the final Hamiltonian that we simulate becomes this model that you have here. And we define for convenience the rescaled mass M0 tilde and the coupling delta of G. And we will be performing scans of the phase structure in terms of these masses and couplings. So the couplings are between minus one and one, which corresponds to G between minus pi and plus pi. So our simulation strategy is to use finite size MPS, and we perform a variational search of the ground state. We start with a randomly initialized MPS with bond dimension 50, and then we gradually increase the bond dimension to 100, 200, and up to 600. Actually, it turned out that there are some bond dimension effects larger than, for example, in the Schwinger model, and to be sure that we are really capturing the correct ground state, we had to go to something like 600. And we also extrapolated to the infinite B limit from the largest bond dimensions, and we performed infinite volume extrapolations using volumes between 400 and 1000. There is also a penalty term in the Hamiltonian, this last term with lambda, since we want to probe the zero charge sector of the T-ring model, then we include this penalty term. And our couplings, as I said, this delta of G is between minus one and one, or actually minus 0.9 and one, and we scan several masses from very small masses up to pretty large masses. Okay, so first I show you some results for the phase structure. Already that something non-trivial is happening is shown in the convergence plots, that for some values of the parameters, the convergence of the variational algorithm was pretty fast, and for some of them it was pretty slow, suggesting that maybe the theory becomes critical as expected. So here you have two examples. On the left, there is this fast convergence where after five or six sweeps, we were basically converged. But in the massless case that you have on the right, we had to sweep for a longer time before convergence set in. Okay, and then the first quantity we look at was entanglement entropy, which can be accessed by performing the Schmidt decomposition. So we cut at some site n between 0 and n minus 1, and in this way we divide the chain into two parts. And then one can come from the Schmidt decomposition, one can compute the von Neumann entanglement entropy. There are at most d non-zero values in the Schmidt decomposition. And then at criticality, one expects to observe the Calabrese-Cardi scaling given by this formula, where small c is the central charge of the underlying conformal field theory, which is expected to be the free bosonic theory in the critical phase. So c should be equal to one. So first we wanted to check whether that the data are consistent with this expectation. And in this slide, you can see the massless case, the Calabrese-Cardi scaling is manifest, at least when the bond dimension is large enough. You see it for both for the large negative coupling and also for coupling like delta of G equals zero. And then in the massive case, which should be there in the next slide. Okay, yes, so that's the next slide. So in this case, you see that for large negative couplings, you still have this manifest Calabrese-Cardi scaling. But then when you increase the delta of G to less negative values and then to positive values, this scaling actually disappears. So it's clear already from these plots that the left plot, that the theory is critical there, while in the middle plot, perhaps there is still some remnant of the scaling, but it's no longer critical. And in the right plot, there is definitely no such scaling. So here, this is consistent with the gapped phase. Okay, we also performed fits of this equation, and we extracted the central charge for large enough bond dimensions. And we found that indeed that there is a regime where the central charge is consistent with one. And this was pretty robust. So up to 1%, it was equal to one. So indeed, there is a phase where the model is equivalent to a free bosonic field theory. When one enforced the fitting equation also in the other regime, then we found values of the central charge compatible with zero. Okay, then our main observables to probe the phase structure were different correlation functions that I will show in the next slides. So then the first one was density, so psi bar psi at some site x1 times psi bar psi at x2. And in the spin language, this is just a sigma z times sigma z correlator, where the sigma z's are separated by the distance x. Then we also looked at the fermion-antifermion correlator, psi bar of x1 times psi of x2, which in the spin language becomes a string correlator, starting with sigma plus at some site n and ending with sigma minus at site n plus x and sigma z in between. So this is a very important correlator in the model because this in the Sine-Gordon theory language, this becomes the soliton correlator. And actually we looked at another type of a string correlator, which has no clear quantum field theoretic interpretation, but in the spin language, this is all sigma z. So sigma z at n and then sigma z up to some site n plus x. The expected behavior is that in the critical phase, there should be power law correlations, so power law decay. And then in the gapped phase, there should be an admixture of an exponential term as you have here. And of course, even if the true behavior is a power law or this power exponential, a finite bond dimension MPS can only be approximated by a finite sum of exponentials. So we also tested a multi-exponential ansatz. One could also look at the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, and this leading the A of the leading exponential, this would be equal to one in the critical phase. But of course, for this one would really need the infinite volume, and at finite volume, there will always be a finite correlation length. Okay, so here I show you the density correlator for different couplings delta of G starting from minus 0.9 and up to one. And in the left plot, you have it on the log scale. And in the right plot, you have the log scale only on the vertical axis. So log linear scale. And for large negative couplings, it's clear that there is a straight line in the log-log plot. So this signals the conformal phase. You see that these are these couplings like minus 0.9 or minus 0.8, while if you go to delta of g equal 1, then it's clear that it's not a straight line in the log-log plot. And conversely, on the right-hand side plot, the delta of g equal to minus 0.9 is clearly not a straight line in this scale, while for delta of g equal to 1, it is a straight line. But it's not trivial to identify where is actually the transition from this kind of plot. So visually, it's definitely not clear. You can see that it happens perhaps somewhere between minus 0.6 or minus 0.7 and minus 0.2, where the left plot does no longer have a straight line, and similarly for the right plot. And there is a similar story in the fermion antifermion correlator. In the massless case, it's all very clear. The theory is conformal, and there is always a straight line, regardless of the couplings. So even for positive couplings, actually, you have this straight line and the power law decay of the correlators. But again, it's non-trivial to differentiate between this power law behavior and the power exponential behavior. And actually, we found that there is a better way, this all sigma z correlator, which has a feature that in the conformal phase, it's still decays as a straight line, so power law. But in this gapped phase, it actually decays to a constant. And this constant proves to be the most robust way of identifying where the phase transition is. So I will show you this in the next slides. So here there is one example for a system size of 1,000 sites for a relatively small mass and for a coupling delta of g equal to minus 0.7. And from this, you can see that the power law decay is quite robust. The fits of the power law are very good. They have a good chi-square. And in the right-hand side plot, of course, the power exponential can still become the power law if A is equal to 1. So these fits are also very good, and also the multi-exponential ones. The A does not come out to be exactly equal to 1, but it's reasonably close for the power exponential, while for the multi-exponential it's a little bit smaller. So we attribute it still to the finite volume, despite the fact that it's pretty large. And actually, to have robust conclusions from such fits, we performed a systematic study of changing the fitting intervals. So in these plots here, you have a fitting interval from 21 to 39. But our systematic procedure went to much larger distances and varied the length of the fits and the range of the fits. And in the end, we had like hundreds of fits from which we could make the results independent of an arbitrary choice of this fit. In this slide, you have the same mass, but a positive coupling. And in this case, it's clear that it's no longer a power law, while the power exponential is a very, very good fit. And A is much smaller than 1. And most importantly, that there is this non-zero value of the constant to which the correlator decays. It's clear even from inspecting the plot, even without fits, it's clear that there is a constant to which the correlator is decaying. And then we, from our systematic procedure, we could get the values of A and this constant C for different couplings and for different masses. And on the left, you have this A parameter, and on the right, you have this constant. and at the phase transition, A starts to get below one. So you roughly see where this is happening, but this is pretty smooth for small masses, and for large masses, it's more abrupt. While in the constant, you see that somehow the precision of this is bigger. The errors are smaller and it's easier to identify where the transition is. But still, for very small masses, you have kind of remnants of this conformal phase, and the constant is switched on very, very slowly. And our final plot for the phase diagram. So this is based on this constant. And on the left, you have it color coded. The black color corresponds to a zero constant. So actually, we admitted a very small value for numerical effects, like 0.001. And then there is a region which is indicated with these bluish colors, where the constant is small, between 0.001 and 0.01, where we cannot be actually sure because of some numerical effects. And as I said, the constant emerges very slowly for small masses. For zero mass, it's always very close to zero. So you have these black points when the mass is zero. This is very robust. But if there is a very small mass, then we cannot ideally identify where the transition is. And also physically, since this is a phase transition of formally of infinite order, it's a very slow admixture of this gapped phase. This gap is very small then, so it all proceeds very smoothly. And there is not really a single point where one can say that the transition happens. But for large masses, you see that the delta of G moves to more negative values at the transition, and the transition becomes more sharp. So the value of the constant becomes immediately pretty large when you cross this transition. On the right, you have it without colors, and there is this gray band where the constant is very slow. So this is something like a crossover region. Okay, one more quantity that we looked at to get some additional insight about the transition was the chiral condensate, which in the spin language becomes the staggered magnetization of the spin chain. It's expected to be zero in the massless limit, and it's important to note that it cannot be an order parameter. Due to the Mermin-Wagner-Coleman theorem, there cannot be an order parameter for a two-dimensional field theory. So let's see how the data reflects this behavior. So for this condensate, we performed the infinite bond dimension extrapolations and also infinite volume extrapolations. And in this slide, I show you the mass dependence of the condensate. So indeed, in the massless limit, you see that the condensate vanishes. Actually, for some time, we had some puzzle that required adding the very small masses, because when we started with masses like 0.4, 0.3, 0.2, and 0.1, it still looked pretty linear, maybe with some quadratic correction to the linear behavior. But if you only had these four points in this regime, you would extrapolate to a non-zero condensate in the massless limit. But then adding larger masses, we could see that there is this significant curvature for small masses, and that it really goes to zero in the massless limit. And also we checked this explicitly in the massless limit, where the condensate is really zero. Okay, so the most important conclusion from this is actually that the condensate can be non-zero in both phases. The black points here, this is the conformal phase, but still you can have a chiral condensate there because you have an explicit mass scale. But it's in the massless limit, this goes to zero. And similarly for the other phase, it's non-zero at non-zero masses, but it goes to zero in the massless limit. So you cannot conclude anything for the phase structure by looking at the condensate. I mean, you cannot identify the phase you are in by looking at this observable, and this is consistent with the Merwin-Wagner. Okay, so now, so this is the end of the phase structure part. So let me again maybe finalize with the phase structure plot. And now I will go to real-time dynamics, which is work in progress. So I cannot offer you any definite conclusions, rather a set of observations, and some comments are also welcome, because I would not say that we understand all that we see there. So in this case, we used uniform MPS and time-dependent variational principle, so not finite size MPS as in the previous slide. And our main motivation was to see whether there are dynamical quantum phase transition. There is an excellent review for this by Markus Heil. And let me introduce it this way, that we performed we prepare the system in the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian that I label H0. And then at some point in time that we label t equals zero, we perform a quench to some different parameter values. So we change either the coupling or the mass or both of them. And then we look at the implied real-time dynamics, which is according to this equation, exponential of minus I times the Hamiltonian times time. And then our question is, can this real-time dynamics contain a phase transition, some analog of a non-analyticity in the free energy that you have in the equilibrium case? The central quantity to look at for this kind of a phase transition is the so-called Loschmidt amplitude, which is the overlap between the initial state, psi zero, and the evolved state. So in other words, it's an expectation value of exponential of minus I ht in the initial state. And this Loschmidt echo, this is the modulus, the square of the modulus of the Loschmidt amplitude. And this object can be interpreted actually as a partition function with boundaries fixed by the initial state and at complex temperature. And this analogy is very useful, because actually the equilibrium phase transitions are related to a non-analyticity in the standard partition function, and the dynamical quantum phase transition can be traced back to non-analyticities in this Loschmidt amplitude. So this kind of a partition function. And these are very interesting phase transitions, and I would summarize it with the words of Markus Heil in his review, that it has been observed in most of the reported cases that DQPDs occur whenever a parameter of the Hamiltonian is quenched across an underlying equilibrium transition. So this part is pretty intuitive, actually. So you start in one phase, you quench to another phase, so your real-time dynamics should somehow notice that you are crossing this equilibrium phase transition. However, notable exceptions exist, suggesting that DQPDs are not in a one-to-one correspondence to conventional phase transitions, so that they are physically something different. And maybe it's not totally understood what they are, at least not in the general case. And I will show you some evidence that indeed this statement is true for the Turing model. Okay, so we look at the transfer matrix. As we know, the standard transfer matrix probes correlations in a given state, and in particular, the correlation length can be expressed as the logarithm of the ratio of the largest to the second largest eigenvalue of this transfer matrix. So the correlation length diverges in two eigenvalues cross, and this implies this non-analyticity in the free energy, so a phase transition. For the real-time dynamics, one can naturally generalize it by constructing the transfer matrix using the initial MPS and the evolved MPS. and the crossing of eigenvalues implies now a non-analyticity in the Loschmidt amplitude. And this is the dynamical quantum phase transition. These mixed transfer matrices using different MPSs were also used to probe interesting relations between static ground state correlations and low energy excitations in this paper. But this is of course a different physical situation than in real time. So now some examples. So on the left, you see a plot for mass equal to 0.3, which is quite large. And this delta of G equal minus 0.85 is in the critical phase. So it's somewhere here. And the final delta of G is zero. So it's pretty deep in the gapped phase. And you see that when we are going from the critical phase to the gapped phase, excuse me, there is a clear crossing of the largest eigenvalue and the eigenvalues that was the second largest up to some time. But if you go to the other way around, so you start at zero and you go towards the conformal phase, actually nothing happens. So there we don't see a dynamical quantum phase transition, even though we are clearly crossing the equilibrium phase transition region here. So this is a kind of a mystery. I don't know how to interpret this, but this seems to be quite universal. You will also see it in the next plots that I show you. One could ask whether the bond dimension that we used, so actually it's pretty small in these investigations. So the question is whether the conclusions are robust against increasing the bond dimension. And actually here you see that yes, they are quite robust. When we increase the bond dimension, the location of the DQPT changes very little. With D equal 30, it's around 4.55, and then it changes very little. So it seems this is not just some artifact. And it's pretty robust in bond dimension. Okay, and here I show you the full spectrum for the same case as in the previous slide when quenching from the critical phase to gapped phase. So let me run this animation. So the largest eigenvalue is the one in red, and you see that at around 4.5, there is this crossing, and now the largest eigenvalue is this one. And you end up with a very nice shape, especially in the context of this workshop. It looks at least a bit like a maple leaf. And then if we go to the other direction, so starting at delta of G equals zero in the gapped phase, and we quench towards the critical phase, then the evolution of the spectrum looks like this. So there is no maple leaf and there is no level crossing. And actually this largest eigenvalue it's maybe getting a bit nearer to the second largest, but not too much actually. So it seems that there is no DQPT, or it's much later in time. We only run until real time 10, so we cannot be sure, but it seems from some other plots that it will not be there. And now I show you the case of a quench in mass. So in this case, we start at mass equal to 0.5 in the gapped phase, and the delta of G is equal to 0.5. You don't see it in this phase diagram. It would be more to the right, but basically we are to the right and up from what is shown in this plot. So very deep in the gapped phase. And if we quench to the massless case, the theory is bound to be conformal. So it's quenching towards the critical phase. So in this case, it looks like this. So again, the red is the largest one, and it's again getting a bit nearer to the second largest, but never reaches this, at least up to time equal 10. And maybe it's a bit far-fetched, but it looks a bit like a spiral galaxy, what we get in this case. And then the quench to the other direction, starting in the massless limit in the critical phase and quenching towards the capped phase. This is what is happening. So you can see the red, and at some point the red gets here, and actually at some later time it gets even here. So in this case, we observe two DQBDs, one at time around 5.5 and one at 9.3. What did I want? Okay, never mind. Yes, so now a few more plots to show some observations that we have. So now we are at mass equal to 0.1, and we are quenching from the critical phase at delta of G equal to minus 0.9. So in the phase diagram, we are here deep in the critical phase. And now we vary the final delta of G. So in this plot, the final one is 0.9, so very deep in the gapped phase, not shown in this phase diagram. But then we also look at 0.3, 0.1, and 0, which are still relatively deep in the gapped phase. And you see that the DQPT moves to later time, which is, I would say, quite intuitive. If we are less deep in the gapped regime with the final delta of G, then it's reasonable to expect that the transition can happen at a later time. Okay, then if we are quenching from gapped to critical, so we are, our final delta of G is now this minus 0.9, and we start with different initial delta of G, then there is no DQPT in either case. And actually, if we are very deep in the gapped phase with the initial coupling, like here, 0.9, then the eigenvalues get closer to each other. But a little bit counterintuitively, if we are less deep in the gapped phase, like minus 0.3, which is here, I don't know actually if you see my cursor, but you can see where minus 0.3 is. So actually there, the eigenvalues do not get very near. And if there was a DQPT at a much later time, I guess one would expect that in this case, they would get closer to each other than in this case. So maybe this is some indication that quenching from gapped to critical, there is no DQPT at all. Okay, I'm getting to the end. So in this case, this is very interesting, the behavior here. So in this case, we are fixing the final delta of G to be 0.9 deep in the gapped phase, and we are starting with different initial delta of G. This case I already showed previously, so there is a DQPT at T around 4. And then it's very interesting what happens later when delta initial becomes less negative. Note that this minus 0.6 and minus 0.4, that this one, that is already in the gapped phase. So in these cases of these three plots, we are quenching from the gapped phase to the gapped phase. And still we observe a dynamical quantum phase transition. So it means that indeed, as Heil was suggesting in this sentence that I cited, is that there is no one-to-one correspondence between the equilibrium phase transition and the dynamical quantum phase transition, because the DQPT can happen even when going from the gapped phase to the gapped phase. So it cannot be the same phase transition, so to say. It's probably related. It's reasonable to assume this, but it's definitely not in one-to-one correspondence. And actually, at some point, if your initial delta of G becomes deeper in the gapped phase, the DQPT disappears. So at minus 0.4, there is a DQPT, and minus 0.3, there is no DQPT anymore. Okay. So this is my final slide before the summary slide, and I summarize here some observations. This plot shows you the time of the real time of the DQPT, and on the horizontal axis you have the final delta of G, and the, with different colors you can see different values of initial delta of G. So as I was telling you, there is no DQPT if quenching is from gapped to the critical phase. To get to the critical phase, your final coupling needs to be very negative. And you see that already if it's around zero, then the DQPT happens at a very late time. And actually, it's not clear. One would have to run these simulations for much longer. So it's unclear how reliable the results would be because of growing entanglement. So it's not clear whether it's that there is some asymptote or maybe at time 100 or whatever, there would be a DQPT. I don't think we can conclude this at this stage. And then going critical to gapped, if you have fixed delta initial of G, then DQPT time moves to a later time when the final delta of G decreases. So you see it clearly in this plot for all combinations of parameters. There is a non-trivial dependence of the DQPT time on both the initial and the final coupling, but somehow a bit stronger dependence on the final one. You see the spread of these points here is not too large, while if you change the final one, the DQPT time is significantly affected. And this interesting feature that DQPT can be observed also when quenching from the gapped phase to the gapped phase, but the initial one cannot be too deep in the gapped phase. Okay, so I come to the summary of the talk. So we don't understand this DQPT totally. There are some observations, but we certainly need to investigate more, and we will be looking at the correlators. As in the equilibrium case, it might be that the correlators can explain the relation of this dynamical phase transition to the equilibrium phase transition, or tell us that this relation is not so important. Okay, so I reported to you our investigations of the phase structure of the massive Turing model using tensor network methods. Our results are fully consistent with the expected picture that there is a conformal phase with manifest Calabrese-Cardi scaling corresponding to central charge equal one, so a free bosonic field theory, and this phase has a power law decay of correlations, and there is another phase with the power exponential decay of correlators, which could be probed by this constant C in the all sigma z correlator. Our results are consistent with a BKT type transition, so the transition proceeds via a smooth admixture of this other phase, so to say, it's not a sharp transition. And this is consistent with the Merwin-Wagner-Coleman theorem. So there is no spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, this is clear. And we also started investigating the real-time dynamics of this model. I showed you some observations for the dynamical quantum phase transition, and this is work in progress where we would still like to understand many more things. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention, and I welcome questions.
Thanks a lot, Christoph, for this very nice and interesting talk. I hope there are some questions or at least some comments to resolve your mysteries, Johannes.
Not a comment to resolve the mystery, but I would like to know if as soon as you leave the conformal phase, is the Turing model that you considered a non-integrable, such that your precise phase location that you determined are fully predictions, or could you? Are there other methods that were done previously?
So you can employ this equivalence, this duality with the Sine-Gordon theory and analyze this RG flow. But I think it becomes non-integrable, yes.
Okay. Other questions or comments? I was wondering, Christoph, how do you measure actually the time? I mean, a number time is 9.9 means nothing, right? You have to measure it in some in terms or in units of some physical quantity.
Right. So yeah, these are some lattice units. I don't think we thought much about this. One would have to think about some scale setting. I cannot really explain what this 9, for example, means, whether it's a large time or not a large time. I have no intuition for this. Actually, it's interesting that in this model, many intuitions from QCD fail, which was not the case for the Schwinger model, where basically everything is pretty much the same as in QCD. The continuum limit in particular, here it's very different. And there are many subtleties in this model. And one would have to look at some physical observable to do this. We have some preliminary results for the mass spectrum, and there are some interesting investigations one can perform there. And then maybe one can say what is this time. Whether
this could
nine
be.
Is large or not.
Exactly. I think this could be helpful to maybe understand this behavior better. Other questions or comments? And I guess I heard this, but are you planning to do some correlation function to really get the pole structure? Or?
Yes, this is natural to look at the correlation functions and to see whether there is this admixture of the power exponential precisely at the DQPT time or not. So the results so far suggest that there is no one-to-one correspondence between the transitions. If we start in the critical phase, it's clear that the initial correlation functions will evince a power law decay. And at some point, I guess there must be a power exponential if we are quenching into the critical phase. I mean, if you fully thermalize, if you could get to this point with your simulation, it's clear that only the parameters of your final Hamiltonian would matter, so you would have a power exponential.
Mm-hmm.
But then whether this transition between the two regimes, whether it happens at the time of the DQPT, this is not clear, and we would like to see this.
Okay, I give it another try. So there's a comment or a question from the audience.
I have a comment because in your case, even if you would quench in the conformal regime, at the end, if the system thermalized, you would have a power exponential decay, right?
If you
using your same reasoning, right?
Conformal to conformal.
Yes, using the same reasoning. So you would have some finite energy density state, and then you would get a power exponential decay.
But why a power exponential?
Well, because it's a finite temperature, right? So if you study a CFT in a finite temperature, then you would get a power exponential decay, where the exponent comes from the finite temperature.
Okay, right. Yeah, because the temperature becomes complex, the time becomes complex. Yeah, I have to think about it. Yeah, but thanks for the comment. Yeah, it's definitely not trivial. At least I don't think I can say we understand this.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I see no further open microphone or raised hand. So Christoph, I want to thank you again for this nice talk. And then I think we can close this session here. And I see you again in 3 hours.